Hey, everybody. The general scientific consensus is that you are listening to another episode of the Psychology of Games podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Madigan. It's my job to reach into the psychology literature and fish out what I think will help you understand why good game design works, why gamers behave as we do, and how some of those who market and sell video games make use of our psychological quirks. This is the episode about morality and moral choices in video games. One quick note before we get started, though. My supporters on Patreon do get an ad-free version of this podcast, plus a few other perks. Patreon.com/POG is a dead simple way for you to donate to this podcast and the website, psychologyofgames.com. Lots of people just like you do it already, so go check it out at patreon.com/POG. That's for Psychology of Games. I think many of us who are into video games have had foundational, formative experiences that we remember for the rest of our lives. The kinds of experiences that make us think, yeah, I'm going to stick with this hobby. It's part of me. I may be dating myself here a bit, but one of my such experiences was with the Ultima series. Not Ultima Online, but the series' early top-down role-playing games that I obsessed over on my Apple IIe. In particular, 1985's Ultima IV, Quest of the Avatar. Ultima IV was unique. I remember being amazed at the unfolding realization that the point of this game wasn't going to be killing some big bad monster evil wizard, like you did in previous Ultima games or the Dungeons & Dragons sessions I ran with my friends. I mean, there was monster slaying and dungeon exploration and all that, but that wasn't how you were going to win the game. To beat Ultima IV, you had to do something unprecedented. You had to be a good, moral person. The new ruler of the land, Lord British, wanted someone to come forth and become an avatar of virtue for his subjects. Someone who could not only fight monsters, but also stand as an example to the right and proper behavior for others to follow. The game presented its moral framework built around 8 virtues: honesty, compassion, valor, justice, honor, sacrifice, spirituality, and humility. The morality system came into play right from the beginning with character creation. Instead of choosing your character's class, you took a kind of personality test from a freaky old lady that you met in the woods. She asked you questions where you would have to choose between virtues, multiple choice style. A bully wants to throw down. Do you fight or walk away? Your lord mistakenly thinks that he killed a dragon when it was actually you who got the killing blow. Do you indulge that belief or tell him the truth? You track down your friend's killer, but find that he has a child. Do you avenge your friend after all, or just walk away? Each question forced you to favor one virtue over another. Depending on which virtues you chose, the test assigned you a class like mage, bard, fighter, or even a humble shepherd. But then the real breakthrough stuff happened. Your actions and choices within Ultima IV would raise or lower invisible gauges for each one of those 8 virtues. Flee combat and you'd lower your valor. Donating money to beggars would raise your compassion, while bragging about your exploits would lower your humility. I, in particular, remember that sacrifice was the hardest virtue for me to figure out how to raise, and I almost gave up before figuring out that you had to go to a healer while at full health and offer to donate blood. Once I figured that out, I thrust my veins into the face of every healer I came across until I was a dried-up, exsanguinated paragon of sacrifice. And so only after you mastered all 8 virtues could you access the end of the game by traveling to the final dungeon, attaining enlightenment, and then becoming the Avatar with a capital A. So the idea of moral choices in video games has been with us for well over 30 years at this point, though it's not always tied so intimately to gameplay as it was with Ultima IV. The Mass Effect series, for example, had its Paragon and Renegade choices where you could either play things more by the book, like Captain Picard, or you could let your fist do the talking like Captain Kirk. Other games, like those in the Fable and Infamous series, let you prove yourself to be pure good or downright evil through your actions, and they would even alter your appearance to match. Companies like Telltale Games have created entire niches for themselves by making narrative-driven adventure games where the whole point of the game is to react to crises and pick sides through the mechanics of moral choice. But what do these moral conundrums and our reactions to them say about us as people and as gamers? Do they say anything about us at all? Are the choices we make predictable? And could the situations a game presents us be tailor-made based on that? What kinds of morals do games tend to focus on? And what are some untapped veins of moral choice that are still out there, largely ignored by video games to date? Or even if we're not making choices about our avatar's behavior in the game, Does seeing them act morally or immorally affect how much we're going to enjoy the game or what we're going to think of it once the credits roll?
And so I think it's this interesting dynamic between the narrative of the story and how that creates a certain type of moral pinnacle or moral guide that we're supposed to adhere to, and then it asks us to violate that drastically. I think that can really lead to really strong emotional responses.
It turns out that psychologists and other academics are now starting to turn their eyes to the question of morality in video games. They're studying what it means to be moral or immoral, how people react to playing games when characters do questionable things, and what effects that has, not only while playing the games, but afterwards. We'll hear from one such expert coming up next. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us for the interview portion of the podcast. Once again, my guest this episode is Dr. Matthew Grizzard. He's here to help us learn and talk about morality and moral choices in video games and how that affects what we think of games and how it may affect us outside of games and so forth. So, Dr. Grizzard, Matthew, or Matt, thanks very much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So who are you and what are you doing here?
So I am an assistant professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Buffalo in New York, and I do research on video games, morality, and media entertainment, and emotion in these areas as well.
Okay, and you are currently on rotation out in Singapore, right?
I am, yeah. I'm teaching two courses here on research methods. I'm about 4 weeks into a six-week course, so coming up on the end.
And then it's back home after the summer's over. Well, thanks for getting up early and talking to me. I think you're about 11 hours ahead of me. So
yeah,
I appreciate it. So let's just kind of get into it. So I wanted to talk about morality in media in general and video games in specific. But I think before we jump into that, it's kind of useful to talk about how is morality typically discussed and modeled in media psychology. So whether you're looking at, you know, television, movies, video games, other types of media, like how do people like yourself typically approach that topic?
I guess about 15 years ago now, there was kind of a big shift in morality in psychology where people started to look at what are the foundational bases of moral judgment. So, you know, morality has been a topic of interest since basically, you know, the beginning of Western civilization with Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, everybody. There was always this kind of focus on, you know, what is a moral decision? What makes something ethical or unethical? And how should people live their lives, essentially? And that kind of dominated thought for, you know, a really long time. And about 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I guess, researchers in psychology started to look at this in a kind of a different way. They started to say, instead of, you know, what is the right thing to do or what is the moral thing to do, how do people make these judgments? And it's kind of a different question because it's, instead of it's being this kind of moral absolute, like you should do this, it's the question of morality becomes, is it relevant to right or wrong decisions? And, you know, people can make the same or different decisions for different reasons. And one person consider it to be very moral and the other person consider it to be very immoral. And so I think, you know, there's been this shift where people start to get interested in how do those decisions get made and how can two people who would both consider themselves to be very moral come to very opposite conclusions.
So it's not so much, is this decision the person made moral? It's more, what was the process that the person went through to make the decision or to decide whether or not it was moral or immoral, or if this character they were watching or interacting with was acting morally or immorally?
Yeah, absolutely. And so it becomes like a question of, is it even relevant to decisions about right or wrong? And if so, then it's a moral decision. And if it's not relevant to questions about right or wrong, if someone's not making a good, bad judgment or a right, wrong judgment, it's kind of amoral, not relevant to morality. And it's kind of a different way to think about morality because it's much more relativistic, it allows for a greater perspective than just this was the right decision. Why didn't this person make that decision?
Okay. So what kinds of things do people take into account when they're deciding if something is moral or immoral or, I guess, amoral?
Yeah, so some really interesting research came out that really got this whole conversation started where people were looking at what's called moral dumbfounding. And so moral dumbfounding is this experience that people have oftentimes where they've made a moral decision, but they can't really justify it logically or rationally. And so these moral decisions that we make tend to be very, very quickly made without necessarily weighing a lot of evidence or thinking carefully about it. And they tend to be these kind of like a split second gut judgment about, oh, I don't like that, so that's wrong, or I do like that, so that's right. Which is, it's kind of a fascinating thing to think about. I'm not saying that, you know, we don't ever make decisions that are rationally based or deliberatively based, but oftentimes we'll make them very quickly without even the ability to weigh that evidence. And if that evidence changes, a lot of times our moral judgment doesn't change. It stays the same even in the face of evidence that's changing.
Okay, so now right now you're making me think a lot about the judgment decision making or behavioral economics research in psychology, which says a lot of the same things about decisions that we make or impressions that we form about the importance of something or the frequency of something or how good or bad something is. So do a lot of those same types of biases and, I guess, more to the point, the mental heuristics, the mental shortcuts, do those apply in the research on morality as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in fact, that decision making stuff is really kind of what got me interested in the topics that I look at. And I think they're really kind of central to video game play and the moral judgments we make in video games. I think they can be seen by the fact that, you know, we tend to make judgments in video games and actions in video games that are moral. You know, occasionally we go on a rampage in Grand Theft Auto, or we do something kind of crazy within a game. And but I don't know about you, but whenever I do that, I always kind of like save my progress before I do the like crazy thing so that I can maintain the narrative in a kind of consistent format.
Frequently. Or I do it on a second playthrough where it's like, okay, this isn't the real experience. This is just something I'm doing to see what would happen if I did, you know, kill the puppy instead of saving the puppy, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. And I mean, I think that says a lot, right? Because if it weren't relevant, or if we weren't using like real world bases to make these kinds of judgments, why would that be relegated to the second time through? Why wouldn't that be just as likely to happen on the first playthrough? And I think that's kind of a interesting question that gets at, you know, maybe we do have these intuitions and these biases that are based on real world experience, or at least our expectation of what the narrative should be, that kind of bleed over into our gameplay.
So how much does that sort of thing differ across people and, I guess, across cultures?
So, yeah, so with the morality, there's some research, like huge samples. One of the studies, I think, had 110,000 participants across basically across the entire globe. And they look for kind of correlates of morality that you would expect some consistency with. And so they find basically that regardless of what culture you're from, if you tend to be more conservative, you tend to place relatively equal bases on all aspects of morality. So if somebody does something that's anti-authoritarian, that's just as bad as if they did something that hurt someone else or that was unfair or unjust. And liberals tend to place greater emphasis on this, on fairness and care and empathy and things like that. And so that pattern tends to be consistent across culture. So even though there's lots of variance within what is a liberal and, you know, maybe the Middle East versus the U.S. or what's a conservative in the U.S. versus a conservative in the Middle East, we tend to see similar patterns of moral judgment. Salience is what it's called. It seems to be that we're getting into something that is universal almost with relation to moral judgments. And it's not just, you know, morality varies based on culture. It does, but it also is maybe something innately human in it as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. So one of the articles that I was reading through, one of the studies that you were involved with, talked about, is it the MIME or the MIME model of morality? And it kind of had these five domains of like, these are the types of things that tend to trigger judgments about morality or perceptions of morality. Or these are like the five domains. And it was like caring, relation to authority. I'm going to see if I can remember them all. Fairness and equality, or I guess fairness in general. And then what were the other two? What am I missing?
Loyalty and purity.
That's right. Yep.
Yep.
So tell me a little bit about that. Is that the types of things you were talking about where more liberal people place more focus on caring and fairness, and more conservative people tend to weigh everything equally?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So those five, again, are care, fairness, loyalty, authority, and purity. And so care is related to hurting other people or helping them physically or emotionally. Fairness is about like reciprocity. So if I do something for you, you should do something nice back for me. loyalty is about maintaining group cohesion, and so being loyal to your group and not betraying a group level, not just an individual. Authority is about respect for legitimate authority and respecting dominance hierarchies. And then purity is about kind of avoiding bodily contamination or things that would be considered disgusting. What we tend to see is that conservatives tend to place relatively equal emphasis on all of these, and there tends to be a split for liberals where care and fairness tend to be more important, and then issues of loyalty, authority, and purity tend to be somewhat less important.
Okay. So if I am to kind of bring this back to video games and media, if I'm, seeing a character in a movie or a character in a game and I see them either conform to or go against these different domains, does that then affect like whether I say that guy's a jerk or hey, I like this guy, or in other words, like that's a moral person, that's a that immoral person?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a lot of what we base our judgments on, is looking at other people's behavior and how important it is for us. So, if you're low on purity, you might not find it unacceptable if a character starts doing drugs, right, or starts visiting prostitutes. But if you are really high on purity, those types of behaviors are likely to be not very well liked and not very well tolerated, and they might negatively impact your judgments of that character.
So then are our judgments made in relation to where we stand on those on these different domains?
I think so. We have some evidence to suggest that that the more important these things are to you, the more you like media that would demonstrate their upholding and not demonstrate their violation. The research is still really early in this area, so I can't say for sure that that's always the case, but it seems to be true.
Like, what does it matter? Like, in terms of media, like if we think that, the protagonist is moral or not, or the antagonist is moral or not. Like, what effect does that have, and what does it matter to the people consuming the media?
So I think it's huge, especially with narrative media. I think, we're a lot of the early research on the show that we're rooting for the characters we like, and we want to see good things happen to them, and we're rooting hard against the characters we dislike. And I think really successful movies and really successful films are the ones that show us the opposite of that, and they get us super worried that the thing that we don't want to happen is going to happen, so that that character we like is going to fail miserably, and that character that we hate is going to succeed. And then at the end, they switch it, right at the end, and the good guy wins, and the bad guy loses. And so I think the morality judgments are central to that process, right? We want to have really good guys and really bad guys, and you want everyone to love the good guy. You want everyone to hate the bad guy, and that really kind of builds towards enjoyment. One conversation that I have with my grad students a lot is about this, because we're researching characters and we're researching endings of narratives. And one of the films we talk about quite a bit is Ex Machina. I don't know if you've seen it or not.
I saw about half of it, and it's one of those that I always meant, this is really good. I should go back and finish it. But yeah, let me put it back on my list. But I'm aware of like the general concept, but go ahead.
So the ending of this movie is quite polarizing, and I don't want to spoil it for you, but I have one grad student who loves the film, and the ending is completely, fitting. And then I have another grad student who hates the film, and it's really because one of the characters does something that just really violates his sense of morality. And when he talks about it, you can see him getting super passionate about this character's decision. So I don't want to spoil the ending for you, but definitely put it back on the list.
So what about like anti-heroes? There are certain types of characters like, the Punisher in comics, or John Wick, more recently in movies like that, where like these are bad dudes, right? They do bad things that most people would say are bad or would not do themselves, would not allow themselves to do. But at the same time, we root for them and we like to see them succeed. So how does that figure in?
Yeah, so that's a question that we've been trying to answer for quite a while as researchers. I've got some inklings on how this works, and we've done some recent studies trying to kind of tease this apart. So I think one of the things is they do bad things, and so I'm not trying to like diminish that. I'm not saying that Walter White is a good person or that Tony Soprano is
That's an
like a
even
good
better
person.
example. Yeah, Walter White. Perfect.
I don't want to be friends with these people in real life, but one of the things I think we have to look at is that within the realm narrative, right, they are the better option of what else we have to look at, right? That's Walter White's a bad guy, but he's not Gus Fring and he's not the neo-Nazi biker gang, right?
Right.
He moves towards that. But
Yeah, he gets worse in some ways, but
yeah,
yeah.
exactly. He moves towards that. So I think, they start off with this difference between the characters, and so even though the Punisher is bad and he's doing things that like nobody would consider to do in the real world, he's the best option in the world we're watching. And so I think that's part of it. The other thing is, I think there are still steps that these characters could go too far and that they would lose the audience enjoyment, right? It's like if you found out that the Punisher was actually a pedophile who made child pornography, right? It's not like there's a lot of people out there that would be like, oh, he's still a good guy. I still like this guy a lot. And so I think writers are really careful about the types of bad behavior that they let their characters do and how far their characters will go before they cross the line. And so I think the line always exists, right, in terms of morality judgments of characters. And there are things that a character could do that would just be beyond the acceptability of any audience. And I mean, the Punisher probably crosses the line for a lot of people and they wouldn't consider him to be a good guy. And so I guess it's that line is kind of what we're interested in, and how that line varies from person to person, and how it varies across domains of morality. So those five things that we were talking about earlier: care, fairness, loyalty, authority, and purity.
Yeah, so I imagine we all consume media for different reasons and enjoy media for different reasons. So that's another way in which the person consuming the media kind of determines whether or not it is quote unquote good or whether or not they enjoy it. So there's something for everybody, I guess. One hopes.
Yeah.
So how good are we at picking out like the good guy and the bad guy and sort of knowing where that line is? And because a lot of movies and games will try to sort of subvert those tropes, right? Like they'll create gray areas and so forth. And then if not gray, like they'll withhold information or information about the character's motives or background and so forth. Does that sort of stuff work to obfuscate the morality, or do readers really just sort of figure it out?
I think it depends on how savvy the reader is. And so I think writers use a lot of, like you said, tropes and schema is what we typically call them in the research area, to set up expectations about characters. So like Snape and Harry Potter, right? You expect him to be a bad guy because he wears black and he looks kind of stern and he
Well,
acts kind of like a jerk
he's kind of an
sometimes.
ass, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Just a little bit of
But he's no Umbridge, which I guess there again is the point.
yeah, exactly. And so I think it can be very effective if the audience doesn't see through this. And so I think some, like getting back to video games, I think some of the best moral judgments or moral scenarios in video games are the ones that you don't see coming. So I think of the Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, the No Russian level, where it's a really jarring experience, right? It sets up the expectations of we're, a good force, and then all of a sudden you're massacring citizens in the middle of an airport.
Right. So that was one where your player character was undercover in this terrorist organization and they go and attack a Russian airport and you have to kind of go along with the bloodshed or you die and you fail the level, right?
I think those are the really kind of really interesting moral scenarios, right? Where there isn't a, there is a clearly a line that's being crossed there, and it really kind of gives the player pause. And if you read some of the interviews with the developers and designers of that level, that's what they talk about, right? They wanted to cause the player to not just fire off bullets like without thinking. And that can oftentimes happen in those first-person shooters where everything's a target and you're just shooting nonstop. To bring in a narrative in that kind of gameplay situation that causes the player to really kind of pause for a minute and think and deliberate is kind of an interesting experience.
Yeah, so what effect does that have on our enjoyment of games?
So I think it really adds to it. One of the things that we've looked at is guilt in video games and moral emotions. So moral emotions are those emotions that we feel when either we witness someone else violate or uphold morality, and if we do that, we might feel like anger or contempt if we see someone violate morality. And then we also have moral emotions related to the self. So when we violate or uphold morality, we might feel pride, for example, for upholding morality, or we might feel guilt or shame for violating morality. And so we try to look to see, does doing these types of things in the virtual environment, right? Violating your sense of morality in the virtual environment, does it lead to similar emotional responses as we would expect in the real world? So feeling guilt for doing something really heinous in a video game. And the work we found shows, and you know, this is based on other people's work. So Thilo Hartmann out of VU Amsterdam, he started this really this us down this path. And so we've been following kind of his work and doing some of our own, and we tend to experience guilt when we do these kinds of things in video games. And it's not always, right? I mean, like when I'm playing Grand Theft Auto, I'm not necessarily feeling guilty, but when I'm playing Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 and I'm asked to like mow down innocent civilians, or if a game were to do something even more extreme than that, you know, I might feel guilt. And so I think it's this interesting dynamic between the narrative of the story and how that creates a certain type of moral pinnacle or moral guide that we're supposed to adhere to, and then it asks us to violate that drastically. I think that can really lead to really strong emotional responses, and
But negative ones, right?
yeah, but negative ones, and I not negative in a sense of like they decrease enjoyment. I think, you know, enjoyment a lot of times in video games is related to just the strength of that emotional response that we feel. And you know, if we're not feeling, if we're right in the middle, right, and we're not feeling really strongly positive or really strongly negative, those aren't very fun games. We want those kind of peaks of even really negative feelings can increase the enjoyment that we have of games.
And it seems like a lot of video games that do hinge on these moral choices. You know, do you go Paragon or Renegade, or do you take this path or that other path? They don't necessarily set up situations where it's like, are you going to be the hero or the heel or, you know, the absolute villain? They set up like, okay, here's like a really tough, crappy situation. And do you want to do this option, which saves these people but kills these, or this option, which does the opposite? It saves those people and kills these. You know, like I was playing through Prey, the new Prey game, first person shooter, very Bioshock-esque, in space. And there's this one point, I guess this is like a minor spoiler, but I'll keep it vague. But there's this one point where there's the shuttle of crew members leaving the space station, and for them, like, to get back to Earth would be risky for reasons I won't get into. So you have this option of like, do you want to blow the shuttle up, or do you want to let, you know, take the chance and let them go, with the chance that like more terrible things will happen to people back on Earth? So, yeah, it seems like a lot of time it's not like, am I going to be just universally violating these principles of morality, and more like, well, which ones do I want to uphold and which ones do I want to break?
Yeah, and I think that's a huge challenge for game developers, right? To create those situations that really do that. I think, like you said, I think like Mass Effect, I think we mentioned earlier, and some of the newer games have done a better job at this than some of the original games. Although Fable was kind of one of my favorites
Yeah,
growing up.
that's right.
That really got me kind of interested in this. But if you look at Fable, they have like a, you're right, it's like good to bad, and there are bad decisions and there are good decisions, and they are the opposite of each other. Whereas with like
Right.
Mass Effect, right, it's there are good things you can do, there are bad things you can do, and they're kind of independent of each other. And so you can build up your Paragon points and your Renegade points simultaneously. It's not like one is, when one builds up, the other one decreases. So I think game developers have a tough time creating those situations that have multiple outcomes that are all equally bad or all equally good, and that are kind of narrative neutral at the same time. You know what I mean?
They don't spin things completely out into like a totally different scenario. Like, how do you work within, you know, the tool, the environments, and the narrative that you have without completely rewriting? Like, no, I'm going to kill my sidekick, and they're not going to be around for the rest of the game. But
So I find that to be kind of, I don't know. As a gamer and somebody who grew up, like, I mean, my first system was the Nintendo Entertainment System back in like '86, I think, is when we got it. And, you know, as a gamer from back then, I always see these things as like, well, what decision should I be making? Which decision did the developer want me to make in order to get kind of the best ending? And I still feel like a lot of games fall into that situation, and I'm always kind of second guessing myself, like, did I make the right decision for the ending that I want to happen? And so it's that's a hard row to kind of hoe, I think, for game developers trying to
Yeah,
make.
you want to, if you're a developer, you want to have a set of decisions where one of them is not the quote unquote right or the correct decision, and the other one is just the extra thing that you do when you quick load the game back in. Which is why I really enjoy like a lot of the Telltale games, those types of adventure games, more recently Life is Strange that I played through a month or so ago. Where
I haven't played that yet.
Yeah, oh, it's great. In your line of work, you should definitely play Life is Strange. And on top of it's just a really good game. It's a really good story. But yeah, you know, they'll show you when you finish like a chapter in these types of games. So they'll do a breakout of like, okay, 45% of players made this choice and 55% made this and so forth. And what's really interesting to me is like how close to 50-50 a lot of those decisions are, and how impactful they are because of it, and how that sort of makes you feel when you see that other people made the same decision, but like an equal number didn't. They made a completely different decision and had seemed to have different values or different priorities. So I like seeing that sort of stuff, and it's the reason why the original season one of The Walking Dead by Telltale. Have you played that one?
Yeah, I have played that one.
That's one of my favorite games in recent memory, just because of the way that the last episode ends, and this series is just gut-wrenching, like, moral choices that you have to make that hinge upon all the other, or many of the other previous choices that you've had to make. And like the way that you end that game, the way that you choose to end that game is a reflection on like your values and your morality. And it's something that video games are sort of uniquely equipped to do. Like, you could not have that experience if you were watching a movie or the TV show The Walking Dead. You might have other equally good experiences, but they would be different because you're not really sort of in control. There's not that sense of agency, and you're not making the call for this character, what happens to this character, or who this character is that you're controlling. So that seems like to be something that the video games are unique in. How does that figure into the theory and the study of morality in games? You know, the fact that you have player agency and you are a co-creator along with the game developer, like how does that figure in?
Yeah. So, like I said, a lot of this research got started in the 70s in terms of media entertainment research and serious, like, scientific study of it. And one of the things that the kind of founding fathers, Dolph Zillman, did was try to combat a lot of like misconceptions that people would have about media experiences. And so one of the big ones is that this idea that you are the character, and that was not really true for film or for novels, right? I mean, occasionally you get like this first person view, but you're not really there.
Beyond the totally avant-garde experimental stuff, yeah.
Yeah, totally. And so, I mean, nobody looks at the screen when the serial killer is sneaking up on the helpless victim yelling, "Look out behind me." They're yelling at, "Look out right. behind you," right? And so he spent a lot of time kind of like trying to disprove these notions in his research, which I think is kind of like ironic in a way, because video games, I do think, are that kind of experience. You are the character, right? Nobody yells "Mario died" when, you know, you fall off the cliff or you don't make the jump, right? It's "I died."
Right.
And so I think you're hitting the nail on the head, right? That it's this really kind of different experience. And I think people are still like, it's a weird experience, because how do you graft a narrative onto that? Do you know what I mean? Like, narratives are designed to elicit similar responses from everyone when they, and the better a narrative can do that, the more widely acclaimed it is, right? You know, you don't want people watching Schindler's List and feeling a bunch of different emotions at the end. You want to lead everybody down the same emotional path so that they get the same emotional payoff.
Right. You got a real specific target in mind in that case. Yeah,
absolutely. And so like, video games have very different kind of like experience, and how do you do that, right? Like, I think a lot of like game developers are still thinking, how do I get the player to feel the same thing at the end, or how do I complete this narrative? And it doesn't work really well. Like, one of the most frustrating games experiences that I can remember of recent years, and a game that was widely acclaimed that I just didn't like at all, was Uncharted 2. There's at the very end where you're like running along this collapsing bridge, like you've just watched like the bad guy get killed by those, I forget what they're called, but they're like some kind of like crazy ape monster things.
Yeah, the blue skin people. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Journey to the Center of the Earth kind of thing, or Time Machine, H.G. Wells Time Machine kind of characters.
Morlocks. Yeah.
But, yeah, yeah, exactly. But as you're running across that bridge, like, I had it on a higher difficulty level when I first played it, and I probably died like 15 times trying to run across this bridge. And every time, he like resets right at the beginning of the bridge, and then you try to do it again. So it's just like cutscene experience where you're just really like, can I perform these actions as I'm supposed to lead to the same payoff? And by the time I got to the end of that game, I was just ready to turn it off. I didn't even care how the narrative ended because I was just like, this is so frustrating right now.
Nathan Drake can just fall in that pit for all you care.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why wasn't that the end? I failed. Like, start back over.
I love every second of the Uncharted games, except the ones that I have to spend actually playing the Uncharted games, is kind of my opinion on those. They're great in so many ways, but they're just not that much fun to play.
Yeah, totally. I think the opposite of that is I've been playing Horizon Zero Dawn a lot
Oh,
lately.
good game. Good game.
Oh my gosh, it's one of my favorites that I've played in a long time. I only play a couple of games a year because I'm super busy with work and then I've got a family and everything. So I try to be what I play, and Horizon Zero Dawn has been one of those. It's just been great. I love playing every second of it, and it doesn't feel like that at all in terms of like, cutscenes that I'm just mashing buttons to get through.
Yeah, so there's like an extremely moral character, Aloy, there in that game, where I think part of her appeal is that, she's got all of these things stacked against her, and yet she is just an inherently good person, and that's expressed through her actions and her priorities as you play through the game. So that's, I think, a large part of the reason for the appeal of that game. So yeah.
Yeah, I really like that game a lot, and it taps into that morality. Like you said, she's in this kind of environment where everything is stacked against her, and I think that's part of the appeal for me as well. I think that ties into my innate morality of where I like to be a little bit anti-authoritarian, and I like to be a little bit skeptical of things. And I see all of these traits of myself in Aloy, and so I think when I play her, it's fun to play as this character.
Yeah, and kind of going back to a topic I discussed with my guest on the previous episode of the podcast, Jesse Fox, who talked to me about avatars and avatar identification and this concept of like the more that you feel like you identify with and are similar to your avatar in a game, the more invested you'll be and the more, all things being equal, the more that you'll enjoy it and the more that you'll like it. So I could also see like avatar identification being perhaps a mediator in this sort of morality equation or model as well, where, you're seeing your avatar do something, your player character do something, and the extent to which you identify with that character might drive whether or not you enjoy seeing them be moral or immoral. Does that make sense, or are you aware of any research in that area?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right. I know somebody who's done some experimental studies on this where they, so like going back to typical games, you do have these moral choices that you get to make, but they tend to be what we think are a limited set of choices. So we've done some research looking at, what of those five moral areas within a player is most predictive of the path they take. And we typically see that care and fairness are the kind of most important predictors of which path you take. And so I feel like the other three are oftentimes ignored by game developers. And I mean, probably because, care and fairness tends to be what people think about the most, but I don't see a lot of decisions where there's a lot of betrayal or authoritarian decisions that are pitted against, caring. So like, you get to be the authority or the anti-authority. You get to be loyal or disloyal, but you don't have to choose between being disloyal or being hurtful or hurting someone else, or being fair or being loyal, right? There's not a lot of like cross moral domain judgments that are asked to be made. And I think that's one area where you couldn't improve a lot of this character and avatar identification, right? And because if my choices are limited in what my avatar can do, if I can't be or if I can't be extremely loyal to this character, right, then and I'm an extremely loyal person, then that doesn't allow me the type of identification or similarity to creep in because I might not have as much nuance in the moral judgments. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
Yeah, it does. And I kind of wonder about real-time strategy games might pick up on some of that, like, Civilization sort of being the most familiar example of that, where you might double cross, a civilization that you were allied with because it suits your needs, or you might accept some disadvantage or some inconvenience because you don't want to, you know, break a relationship that you have and a treaty that you have with another civilization or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love those games. Civilization's like, I play that way too much though, so I had to uninstall it from my computer.
Yeah, it's the only way. Only way, yeah, to be sure.
Yeah, exactly.
So what kind of is the state of the research on studying morality in games and how those types of systems affect how people play games and how they enjoy them and the choices that they make?
So I've got a grad student working on some of these questions right now, and they're kind of looking at guilt, which is something we've looked at before, but they're trying to figure out, you know, to what extent are players attributing their actions to themselves versus the narrative that the game has set up. So if I have that, you know, if I can say I'm not doing this because I wanted to do this, I'm doing this because I think the narrative is asking me to, or this is who my character is in the narrative, we might not expect the same kind of real world reactions, like feeling really guilty or feeling pride or whatnot, as if you feel like you are the impetus of this decision. So it's because I want to do this that I'm doing this. So he's trying to look in that area. Honestly, games are really hard to research.
So I've heard. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things we strive for in social science is a lot of control, especially in experimental studies, over, you know, in what way do you experience this game? And if there's a lot of variety that can happen in a particular instance, it's really hard to maintain any type of internal validity and being able to attribute, you know, specific effects to specific causes, because there's just so many things that vary at the same time.
Those confounds, those alternative explanations for your findings, you can never be sure unless you've battened everything down as much as you can. But once you start to do that, what you're working with looks less and less like the real world thing that you're trying to investigate.
Yeah, it looks less and less like a game. It looks more and more like a movie. So it's
true.
It's tough. And I think people are trying to make progress. And I think, you know, some areas that are probably useful would be looking at server-side decisions, if we could get that kind of data, right? Looking at how people make...
What is that, a server-side decision? What do you mean?
So, like, you know, a lot of companies like Telltale Games, what we were talking about earlier, when you make that decision, you see how other gamers have decided. And so all that data in terms of consistent playthroughs and looking at, you know, what types of decisions were made by the same player over time could be a really useful thing for, I think, unlocking some of these questions. Because if I can trace, like, for example, when you get to that 50-50 split, and you said, you know, before it was like 55-45, if you might be able to predict, right, which side of that 55-45 you fell on based on the earlier decisions that were made. And so I think there's a lot of data that could be looked at there to try to understand how consistency of decisions are in games. And I think that's, you know, I think that's super central, because we don't expect them to be random. We don't expect people to just, you know, randomly go through the game and pick things out, but looking at what decisions are made and how they're made over time could be an area to kind of look at strategies that players are engaging in, or at least infer the strategy so that they could be tested in a more controlled setting.
So what do you think would be the greatest possible gift this line of research could give to game developers, to the ones, you know, making the games and setting up these types of decisions? Like, what would be the thing that you think they could find the most value out of?
So I think the biggest thing that I would like to see them do, because as a gamer myself, and as what I'd like to see in games, is to start to broaden that moral landscape and start to incorporate a lot of the areas of morality that aren't typically thought of as being moral decisions. So like purity, impurity, loyalty, disloyalty, authority, anti-authority. I would like to see that landscape get kind of broadened out, because a lot of times the decision really just comes down to, do I hurt someone or do I not hurt someone? And
right,
even in the like really sophisticated moral games of today, the decision oftentimes is that, do I hurt someone or do I not hurt someone? And I think if we could get more variance, more of a moral palette, right, a broader moral palette, we might see some more interesting experiences.
So it's not just save the puppy or kill the puppy, or maybe get the puppy to learn how to cook meth with you.
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that would then provide sort of a wider variety of situations and wider variety of experiences, and perhaps things that people had never really considered as possibilities for moral choices in games.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I can definitely see that. What kind of games can you think of that are sort of the best examples of the effects of morality in games, where either they had like a clear-cut effect on how you or other people enjoy the games, or they were just sort of perfect textbook examples of this sort of thing in practice?
Yeah, so I think that Call of Duty Modern Warfare level, that one really resonated with me. Yeah, that one really resonated with me when I was playing that game. I never really experienced something like that before. I think, you know, Grand Theft Auto is an interesting situation, but I don't think it's probably the most interesting morally. I think it's, and that's the one that often gets pointed to a lot. Like, if I'm just having conversations with people, they tend to ask, you know, like, oh, that Grand Theft Auto, that's really bad, right? And I'm like, well, it's interesting. I wouldn't say it's really bad. It's no different than watching Goodfellas, I would say, or, or kind of like a Martin Scorsese film. But I think the simpler games, like not really simple, but simpler in terms of like graphical display. So like you said, I think the Telltale games are really kind of interesting because they're not these kind of super amazing graphics, super amazing gameplay elements. It's really kind of this decision-making process that makes them a really kind of interesting experience. And I think that kind of rich emotional response is what really is underlying morality. And so the more we can get of that, I think the better.
Yeah. And it seems like, that's really what you're getting at is some sort of emotional reaction, a strong one, if you can get it. Like that seems to be the point of these types of situations or these types of choices or these strongly moral or immoral characters and NPCs that get presented is to elicit some sort of, you know, affective response from players.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So any other research that you've been involved with that we haven't touched on that you wanted to bring up?
Well, so a lot of that earlier research that I had done on games where we were looking at emotional responses, we found that if a game does elicit a moral emotion like guilt, it leads to greater thinking about and greater reasoning around morality. So you actually become a little bit of a stricter moral judge
outside of the game.
Yeah. And so we've been extending that to news media lately. In fact, we've been looking at graphic violence in news media and whether or not it should be censored or displayed kind of explicitly. And we're finding similar patterns. More graphic displays of violence lead to greater caring and greater moral responsiveness of individuals. So more willingness to kind of stop whatever cause was there. So we've been trying to look at these kinds of general responses that aren't just limited to games, but are related to some type of psychological process that we would expect to exist in lots of different media.
Hmm. So if you see the carnage, if you see the bodies and the destructions, it'll make you care more and so forth, relative to just being, see a bullet list of statistics, for example.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we're not obviously the first people to start looking at this, but we are, I think, trying to like point out how current standards might, especially current media standards, might kind of prevent these types of things. Because, I mean, if you look at like the Society of Professional Journalists, for example, in the U.S.
They have rules, right?
Yeah, they have rules, and their rules steer you away from graphic content and whatnot for fears of like being labeled a sensationalist and whatnot. But
that's interesting. And yeah, Tying back into video games, I wonder if these types of games that have like a message or the types of, you know, interactive experiences that try to convince someone of a viewpoint or get them to change a habit or take on a different perspective, if that would come into play as well. I imagine so. Hey, somebody should study that. Yeah, get a grad student on that.
Yeah, right away.
There's a PhD dissertation. This is all free. Yeah. Anybody can take that.
Yeah, waiting to happen right there.
Exactly. Excellent. Anything else before we wrap it up? I know we're coming up on an hour, and I don't want to keep you too long, although I imagine we could keep talking for quite some time about this stuff. But any other research or studies you want to point people at or mention?
You know, one thing that I've been thinking about lately is that kind of ties back into morality are the consequences that are associated with it. And so I think we haven't really talked about that, but I think the decision making itself is almost less important from a developer standpoint than the consequences they associate with those decisions.
How do you mean?
So, you know, a lot of times if you make a specific decision in a game, there's no real consequence either way, right? So if I harvest the little sister or if I don't harvest the little sister, it's almost irrelevant in terms of the scheme of things. I mean, if you make a consistent where you save everybody, I think you get a payoff at the end of BioShock for that, but
a slightly different ending or an achievement or something, yeah.
Yeah, but it's almost like, well, so what did it matter that I made that decision? And I think, you know, in other games like the Telltale series, you know, there are kind of more important consequences that are associated with it. But again, I think that becomes a difficult thing to program, right? How do you create a narrative where all of these decisions could have happened at any one point in time, and what do we do after that?
Yeah, I think it's also an issue of like that people would look at that as wasted resources, right? So if like there's this whole other chunk of the game that you only get if you made a certain number of decisions in a certain way, and like nobody ever sees that, and I imagine the people in charge of the books and looking at how much time is being spent on making this game would wonder like, why, what are you doing? Why did you spend like 7,000, you know, man hours creating this whole thing that only half the
Yeah.
players are ever going to see?
It'd be interesting if we could. I mean, I think, you know, that's something we'll see more of in the future when like artificial intelligence gets a little bit better about creating these environments and everything. But it's something that I think, you know, maybe in the next 15 years we'll start to see more of that. But
Yeah,
who
very
knows?
cool. Very cool. So, as we wrap up, a couple of questions I always like to ask. One is, you actually already answered, which is, what have you been playing lately? It sounds like Horizon Zero Dawn. And
Yep.
anything else, or is that pretty much it?
I still love the classics, so I've got a RetroPie that I play a lot of like old
Oh, cool.
Nintendo games. I finally beat Karate Kid, which I've been trying for Nintendo that I've been trying to beat since I was six, I think. So
You are now a man
I am now a
or an
man,
adult.
absolutely.
Yeah, how far are you in Horizon?
So I've just gotten to kind of that western town. I forget what it's called. I haven't played it a lot since I've been here, but
Meridian, the big town?
yeah, that's it. So I'm about 25% of the way through. I've
Okay.
been trying to do everything as I unlock it as well, because this
Wow.
is one that I want to get 100% on. So
That'll slow you
I'm kind of
down.
slow. I will. I'm slow going.
Yeah, that's a great game. That game goes places, and the story is legitimately interesting. You just kind of want to know, like, what is Aloy's deal, and what is her origin, and what are the answers to these questions? And
She is such a fantastic character too, just so interesting. Like, I don't know, I just love playing as her. Like,
yeah, she's
fantastic game.
really well written, and I really enjoy the voice performance. Ashley Birch did the voice for her, and the animation. Especially the facial animation for her and the other characters is top notch too.
Yeah, it really is. It's great.
So it all kind of stacks up. I finished it and did a bunch of the extra stuff and didn't get around to doing like all the collectibles because there are a lot of collectibles in that game.
There are a lot.
Yeah, finding all, what is it, like the flowers and the statues and all of that different stuff. I just kind of
Yeah.
eventually burned out on that, but yeah, I put a ton of hours into that game, and they announced some DLC at E3, which I will definitely pick up when it comes out.
Yeah, I heard that. That looks great too.
So that's cool. So I yesterday just finished Inside by Dead Play. Do you ever heard of that one? Or you ever heard of Limbo that came out a
Oh
few years ago
yeah, I remember Limbo.
on last generation of consoles? So Inside is the next game from those people. I'm like 99% sure it's the same people, almost sure. And if it's not, it's very much like that game, but sort of like polished and refined. Just a gorgeous game. Like, it has this incredible, like, mostly black and white kind of look to it, and the animation for everything is top notch. And it's like a 2.5D side scrolling puzzle type game. So you play like this, what appears to be a little boy running through this environment, and like solving physics based puzzles and progression type puzzles. It's really done, really well done. It's only about 4 hours long, which I actually appreciate these days. If I can get a really
Oh
good
my gosh,
gaming
me too.
experience in anything less than like 10, 15 hours, I count that good. Clocked in about 4 hours with this and loved every minute of it and enjoyed every penny. But going back to the topic of morality in games, it was interesting. Hey everybody, it's Jamie from the future. Listen, if you want to avoid spoilers for Playdead's Inside, what you're going to want to do is skip ahead about a minute and a half from this point, and then you should be all good. Otherwise, listen on. The game sets up where, like, okay, you seem to be like this little child, like escaping some facility, running mm-hmm. away from, you know, people with guns and dogs and so forth. And then as the game starts to progress, you realize that you're not breaking out of a facility. You're like trying to get into a facility.
Oh, wow.
And like the purpose, like everything that you sort of assumed up front based on your knowledge of video game tropes and these types of situations. And, you know, our brains are really good at like filling in the blank spaces of narratives with things that we, mm-hmm. we're familiar with and that we draw from. But that a lot of that turns out to be wrong. And then there's like this, I won't spoil it, but there's this huge like WTF switch that happens towards the end of the game. And it's just kind of amazing. And you realize that like, oh, wow, this is not what I expected before. And maybe like, maybe this character I'm controlling is not as much a good guy as I thought he was, or as much like the underdog that I thought he was. And it really kind of switches, because now you're thinking like, holy crap, like the stuff that's going on is totally crazy and I'm not sure if I'm cool with it. And this is like not the scenario that I thought it was at the beginning of this game. Really, really well done, really subtly done. And you, the game drops enough hints that you start to sort of suspect that sort of stuff the further along you go. That's a really great game. I enjoyed it immensely. Yeah. And if you got 4 hours and to spare, and you know, I think it's like $15 or so, or even cheaper on sale on Steam. It's on PC, at least that I played it, although I think it's on consoles as well. I highly recommend
it. I'll have to pick that up, because I like the shorter games myself. Like, I don't have the time. I can play one game a year, maybe, that I have to devote like 30 or 40 hours to, but the rest of them, I want them to be short experiences.
Yeah, you could play a couple of evenings. It's great.
Yes. So your description of that switch at the end reminded me a lot of, did you ever play Crackdown for Xbox 360?
Oh yeah. Love Crackdown. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that ending was the, yeah, very much the same way, where it's like, wait, what? What did I do?
Yeah. You are not the good guy that you thought you were.
No, not at all.
Yeah. You're actually a tool of the Authorian state. I'll go ahead and spoil Crackdown. That game's like 10 years old at this
point. Yeah. Spoiler alerts like expire, right? At some point.
At some point. Yeah. So that's very cool. So I appreciate your coming on. This was really interesting discussion. Where can people go on the internet to learn more about you and your work?
So they can find my webpage at the University of Buffalo. That's where I keep some stuff. And then I've got a WordPress blog. I think it's MatthewGrizzardPhD.wordpress.com. And then I'm on Twitter at MattGrizz, MattGrizz.
Excellent. I'll include links to those in the blog post that goes up with this episode of the podcast. Well, thanks again for taking the time to do this. This was really interesting. And as I think I mentioned to you before, this is one of the questions that I get a lot. And it's one of the ones that I haven't gotten around to talking to an expert about. So I'm glad that I found the right person to shed some light on this area. And it sounds like it's an evolving field that more people are going to be tackling. So I imagine
absolutely
cool stuff coming out in the future.
Yeah, a lot of fun stuff coming up. So.
Hey, excellent. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Psychology Games Podcast.
Thank you for
I hope you
me.
Enjoyed
this
that one. And remember that if you like this stuff, you can go to psychologyofgames.com right now to find literally hundreds of articles that I've written and dozens of back episodes of the podcast. If after that you're feeling generous, you can review the podcast on iTunes, follow me on Twitter or Facebook, or check out patreon.com/POG to support me there. Links for all that stuff can be easily found at psychologyofgames.com. So go find something interesting, and I'll talk to you next episode.